Chapter 2, Guided Through the Maze. Top of chapter quote by Georges Louis Borges. There is no need to build a labyrinth when the entire universe is one. Coventry City Manager Jimmy Hill resigned 3 weeks after I moved into digs in the city and started my professional career. Noel Cantwell, a lovely guy, replaced him. I'd watched Noel from the crowd playing for Manchester United at Leicester only a short time before, and now here he was, my club manager. Jimmy Hill went into television, where I would meet and work with him a lot of years later, while Noel had the job of keeping a Coventry City team in the top division with a playing staff of limited ability at that level. The fact that he did, with some very close shaves, is testament to him. Noel had a big heart and was a great support to me. What the Coventry first team lacked in top-class talent, it more than made up for in characters. Laughs were never far apart with that group, including the excellent goalkeeper, Bill Glazier, who always talked extreme posh when he was pissed. You knew he'd had too many when he stopped dropping his H's and G's and put them all in the wrong places. Then there were two players that Cantwell brought in, Maurice Setters, who played with him at Manchester United, and Ernie Hunt from Everton. Both were hysterical. Ernie was one of the most skillful players I ever saw at close range, and certainly the funniest. He would launch into one of his stories or songs in his broad West Country accent, and you were crying. Maurice was a defender who couldn't run, had bow legs, carried too much weight, and was much smaller than most of the forwards he was marking. Despite all of this, he was rarely bettered. He knew all the tricks, little push here, little kick there, just at the right moment. I learned so much from his long experience in the many games we would play together. Cantwell's job was not helped early on when the main wooden stand at the Highfield Road ground burned down one night. I was called early next day by youth player Graham Paddon, who went on to win the FA Cup with West Ham, to tell me there had been a fire. We met up and walked around the corner of the terrace street to see fire engines everywhere and a big hole in the stand. We went inside one end that was still intact, and there was Cantwell. He sent us in to get the boots out of all the first team players, and firefighters were still inside with big wooden rafters continuing to burn. We were ankle deep in water. The next day I read in the paper that Cantwell had rushed into the burning stand to save the boots. Well, not quite. I was wearing a black jumper and the smell of smoke never did wash out. Imagine getting past the clipboard bloke to enter a still burning building today. I was 15 and weeks out of school when I began to play for Coventry's under 18 youth team with and against people who were often bigger, stronger, and certainly older and more experienced. Some were even playing in the first teams of top division clubs and came into the youth team only for big cup games. The game was so much faster than I knew. The shooting harder and the physical side of things much tougher, even sometimes brutal. I had to grow up real quick and get up to speed in every way, mentally and physically. No account was taken of your age, 15 or otherwise. You had to perform or you were out. It was a real challenge. I also had to cope with the blow a few months into my professional career of being dumped by the girl at Crown Hills, which took a lot of getting over emotionally, with the hormones still in a state of transition. I was not helped by an older cousin from Leicester, who I'd never met before I joined Coventry. He played central defender in the youth team. He was 3 years older and one of the most truly arrogant people I had experienced at that time. Every goal conceded, caused by his mistake, had him pointing at the kid behind him, in other words, me. He went on to become a first-team player with a few clubs and then sank without trace. I'm sure in his old career, in his own mind, he never conceded a single goal that wasn't someone else's fault. What I was in those days was super fit. I would win cross-country runs by a mile, often literally, against much older first-team players, even though I was just out of school. I could run like the wind, as they say. And what an irony that fitness would plague my career. I also obsessively wanted to learn and improve. I would still be on the training pitch working on some skill or other when official training was over. The top competition in professional youth football was the FA Youth Cup, the youth equivalent of the FA Cup, in which every professional club competed and many that weren't. In that first season, when I was still 15, we progressed through the rounds to the semi-final. This was a serious achievement in the light of the competition we had to overcome. I played in the first game of a two-legged semi-final away at Crystal Palace. We got a 1-1 draw, which was good with the second leg to come at home. Then, crash. My life was about to change in so many ways in a matter of minutes. I was sitting on the grass at Coventry's Ryton training ground in the spring of 1968, the day before the second leg, when the youth team manager, Pat Saywood, a former player with Aston Villa, read out the team he had selected. He prefaced his announcement with the words, "Some of you are going to be disappointed when you hear this." Saywood then read out the team, and I wasn't in it. What? I had played in every game this far. I had never really liked or trusted Saywood, and I liked him even less now. I always felt he lacked integrity, and I wasn't wrong on that one. I was 15. I'd played in every round of the competition, including the first leg of the semi-final, and he dropped me without even having a word beforehand, trying to soften the blow, or at least giving me a warning. The first I knew was when he read the team out. Even worse, he then said that all the players in the team should go with him for a training session and the rest of us should grab a ball and have a kick around. The teacher's words at the Leicester School's trial were repeated, only this time there was going to be no happy ending, quite the opposite. I was in a daze as I watched the team I'd played in all season, they would go on to lose the final, disappear into the distance, leaving a handful of us to our own devices. The dark day, actually the dark 20 minutes, was not over, however. We set up a training practice with someone crossing the ball into the goal area, and I would come out and catch it under pressure from other players. Soon after we started, a big lad jumped at me and buried his knee into my left thigh. I went down like I'd been hit by sniper fire. Agony was not the word, and it was turning out to be a really great day, or 20 minutes. I was helped to the club physiotherapist, Norman Pilgrim, who was a real nice chap. He diagnosed a hematoma, quote, "an abnormal collection of blood outside of a blood vessel," quote, which can follow a blow of the kind that I had. It looked like an egg sticking out of my thigh. We called them weekatomas at Coventry. Norman would send us home for a week to rest before starting treatment. In a single day, I had gone from looking forward to playing the following night in the semi-final second leg in front of a big crowd at Coventry's Highfield Road Stadium to sitting alone at the guest house where I lived in Westminster Road in Coventry with my thigh strapped and my heart broken. A vital preparation for where my life would go was to become incredibly emotionally strong. I wouldn't otherwise survive where my path would take me. Anyone who couldn't deal with an unyielding emotional onslaught, let alone mere disappointment, would go under fast in the wake of what was to come for me. Life so often gives you your greatest gifts, brilliantly disguised as your worst nightmare. Look at your own life and you'll see how the bad times gave you the chance to become wiser, more empathetic, and emotionally strong. I've had many emotional blows and disappointment in my life, with many great moments too, to give me the emotional strength to keep going no matter what is thrown my way. These experiences can destroy you or make you emotionally unbreakable. It's your choice. I chose the latter. You only survived my father's short-fused personality if you had emotional strength, and it started early for me, exactly as pre-planned. My life has confirmed the words of German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844 to 1900. One must need to be strong, otherwise one will never become strong. I would like to say that things improved after those 20 minutes that changed my life, but honesty prevents me. They were about to get worse, much worse. When the strapping was removed, my left knee was clearly very swollen. I was told that blood and debris from the blow had gathered in my knee. My body systems would soon absorb it, and I would be fine, was the inaccurate medical conclusion. The knee remains swollen to this day, and yet not once have I had any pain in all that time. Norman Pilgrim and the club surgeon at the local hospital were increasingly bewildered when the swelling wouldn't go away. I didn't play for about 6 months while everyone tried to work it out. Given there was no pain, they advised that I start playing again and see what happened. I did. The knee was fine despite being swollen, and the most successful period of my Coventry career began. The following season, when I was 17, I played in a youth team full of highly talented players, and captained by Dennis Mortimer, who would go on to captain Aston Villa when they won the European Cup in 1982. By now, I was super confident, both as a goalkeeper and an individual. The diffident little kid at Whitehall was like another life. My best mate was Coventry player Bob Stockley, who would play for Wimbledon in a memorable FA Cup run in the 1970s. People in the UK who remember the famous television series The Likely Lads will get the feel for our relationship. We would go out to nightclubs and discotheques full of hope of meeting girls and always go home alone. We had so many laughs, though. He was a great kid, a great bloke, and I hope he's well. Every summer, Coventry would play football tournaments in the Netherlands, one time France, against the top teams in Europe, including Barcelona and Real Madrid. My experience, horizons, and sense of individuality and personality were developing fast. We once again progressed through the rounds of the FA Youth Cup in the 1969-70 season, and beat Manchester United 1-0 at Old Trafford to reach the final against a Tottenham Hotspur team that included top players-to-be Graham Souness and Steve Perriman. I say top players-to-be, they were already outstanding, and Souness was a real character even at 16. He was every bit the fuck-you player, manager, and now TV football pundit that he went on to be. I liked him. He was an arrogant bugger, full of himself for sure. He was also a one-off. I like one-offs. The final was over two legs, but the teams were so close in ability that it went to four games before they beat us 1-0 in the famous White Hart Lane to take the trophy. It had been a fantastic season, although, as it turned out, a brief respite from reality. The next season, I was too old for the youth team, and Coventry loaned me to other clubs to get experience playing at a higher level. I spent 3 months at Oxford United, then in the second division, now the Championship, and captained by Ron Atkinson, or Big Ron, he was, who went on to make his name as a football manager at clubs including Manchester United, and then as a brilliant football pundit with his Ronism phrases that set him apart. There was early doors, as in get at them early doors, which means to get at them from the start. I have no idea where the doors come in. He was already using that phrase back at Oxford. His TV career was destroyed by the political correctness mob when he made an apparently racist remark when he thought the microphone was off. PC tyranny has no forgiveness, and no mistake is allowed. They have to destroy you. It's what they do. I say the remark was apparently racist. While it was not at all nice, to say the least, I knew Ron Atkinson in a number of football and TV situations here and there over the years, and the last thing he was is a racist. It was he who gave black players their big break when he managed West Bromwich Albion and built a team around them. None of this mattered. The PC mob is consumed by its deluded sense of self-righteousness, and once it smells blood, it has to taste it too. Lift the mask from the self-righteous and you always find they are everything they rail against. I remember Oxford United for breaking my thumb and for my right ankle swelling for no reason. This time, unlike my left knee, it was painful. Very. What the hell? What was going on? The swelling wouldn't go down and I headed back to Coventry for treatment. I tried to keep going and I was picked as substitute goalkeeper when the Coventry first team played away at Bayern Munich in a European competition, with football legends in their team like Franz Beckenbauer and Gerd Müller. Coventry lost 6-0, and it would have been 20 had I been on the pitch. My ankle was heavily strapped and I was in serious pain. It settled down a bit, although still swollen, and I went on loan to Northampton Town, where I felt weakness in my left knee, although still not pain. Back again, I went to Coventry, and they thought it must be a damaged cartilage. I had an operation to have one removed, and it wasn't the cartilage. By now, my left elbow was swollen too, for no apparent reason. The inevitable happened when I was given the news that I probably had rheumatoid arthritis and my career was over. I was just 19. What had started with those big boots at Whitehall had run its course, or so it seemed. Obviously, I was gutted. The worst part was driving back to Leicester to tell my father. He had lived a very challenging life, and I knew what a buzz it gave him to have me break the mould in a way. He walked out to meet me from the Gents Clock Factory, where I would go with my mother as a kid to get that week's pay on a Thursday lunchtime. It was a horrible moment. My father did have a trait that led him, in the wake of disappointment, to take his anger and frustration out on someone, and this time it was me. Our relationship broke down for years after this as a result, and even when it was patched up, it was never really the same again. In this period, I'd met Linda, who I married within months of our first meeting, and she would be my wife for the next 29 years. She's still a great friend, lives down the road, and helps me in many ways that allow me to focus 100% on what I do. We had three children, Kerry, Gareth, and Jamie, who are all stalwarts of freedom and give me tremendous support. I needed a friend in Linda and some warmth and love at that time, for sure. My football career was over. I'd been effectively thrown out of my home by my father, and I had nowhere to sleep. Linda lived in Leamington Spa, not far from Coventry, and she was a Coventry City supporter who watched those FA Youth Cup games at Highfield Road. She helped me find a guest house in Leamington to live for a week, and then a flat. Funnily enough, our family doctor in Leamington was to be Vernon Coleman, who nearly 50 years later was one of the leading voices in the UK exposing the COVID scam. And we shared a stage at a big public rally in London's Trafalgar Square in 2021. So what now? I was called around this time by John Campkin, a director of Coventry City, an owner of a chain of travel agents with their headquarters in, of all places, Leamington Spa. He asked me what I was going to do, and I said I still hadn't given up on continuing to play if my joints settled down. John was a former sports journalist on national newspapers, did some television commentary, and had a lot of contacts in football. He offered me a job at his travel agency. I was terrible, and said he would ask around a few football clubs. What came back was an offer from a football great, John Charles, who was manager of a then semi-professional club, Hereford United. Colossal John was known as the Gentle Giant, and he was a legend in Italy, where he played for Juventus. I played against him for Hereford when he moved on to manage and play for another club, and he was a handful even at over 40. John Charles was a terrific bloke, far too nice to be a football manager, although he did sell me a wreck of a car once, from which bits periodically dropped off like a clown car in a circus. Rust was holding it together, well, most of the time. Hereford played in the Southern League, which was outside the fully professional leagues and involved playing a couple of times a week with a training session where possible. Players had other jobs, like I did at the travel agent, until my uselessness led to me leaving. That job sure confirmed my instincts that I could never do a proper job. My boredom threshold was far too low. John Charles would leave Hereford a few months after I joined to be replaced by Colin Addison, who would make his name as a player-manager who led the club on an historic FA Cup run that included a famous victory over top division Newcastle United in 1972. I had been in the team at the start of the season and lost my place with a month-long injury. I couldn't get my place back for the cup run. The following season, Hereford were promoted into the professional leagues and I became a full-time professional again. My joints had settled down. The swelling was still there, but not much pain. For now. The season was a reverse of the previous one. I started out of the team and then regained my place early on to stay there to the end when we won promotion in our first professional season. When I look back, I always seemed to play in successful teams from the first one at Whitehall through to Hereford. We were playing in wonderful atmospheres at home where the ground full signs went up every week. And in those days, the football club was the focus of attention for pretty much the whole town. Hereford United, We All Love You, was not only a club song, it was the way things were. My career had been resurrected, and after all had seemed lost. I was just 20, playing in goal for a professional first team, which was rare for a goalkeeper so young. I had conceded the least number of goals that year in the entire four divisions of the Football League in England. I had also by then conceded the least number of goals per game of any goalkeeper in Hereford United history, a record the local paper tells me still stands. All was well in my world. I was on my way again. Well, not quite. There was a subtext that only Linda and I knew about. Hereford is the home of the SAS, the elite special air services of the British Army, which had a base just outside the town at a place called Credon Hill. They had first-class sports facilities and pitches for the time, and we used to train there every day. Imagine that being allowed now. But this was long before 9/11 and the fake war on terror. As the season progressed, the cold mornings came and my arthritis returned with a vengeance. I couldn't tell the club or they would have looked for a new goalkeeper, and I was playing so well, it wasn't obvious there was a problem, except every morning at Credon Hill during the warm-up. My joints would be stiff and agony until they were warm. Every day, I awoke with the knowledge that I would soon face at least half an hour of sometimes excruciating pain. I made every excuse for the limps. Oh, I've got a bit of a pull. Oh, I think I've got a blister coming. It was always the same cause. the arthritis in my knees, both by now, and my ankles. There's always something wrong with you, Ikey, other players would say. And I would laugh while thinking, if only they knew. Amazingly, I never felt pain in the actual games, which seems inexplicable. I can tell you that if you want to bring out a fierce determination in someone not to give in, then make them warm up with rheumatoid arthritis on cold or freezing English mornings if they want to remain a professional footballer. That'll do it. There was one incident that season that gave me a powerful insight into the fact that the reality we think we see is not all there is. I have been open to that all my life, although this was my first direct experience. We were playing a cup game at Barnet, the old Underhill ground in North London. It was packed that night and one hell of an atmosphere. Newcastle giant-killing Hereford United were quite a draw at the time. I remember the ball falling to a Barnet player about 15 yards from goal, and he hit it first time with terrific power. Often as a goalkeeper, you think this is in when the ball is hit, and then somehow you keep it out. This was one such occasion. I saw the ball leave his foot in real time, but then everything went into slow motion. Sound became silence as I moved across to my left towards the direction of the ball. I launched myself from the ground as the ball headed to the top left-hand corner. All in slow motion, to my experience, and with no sound. I arched my head back and saw my right hand touch the ball and divert it just enough to go an inch or so over the bar. The moment I touched the ball, everything surged back into normal speed, and the sound of the crowd crashed back in like pressing the unmute button. As I landed and teammates ran over to say, "Great save, Ikey," I lay there thinking, what on earth just happened? Well, perhaps not what on earth. That experience never left me, and I can still see it now as I write. It was the best save I ever made. Blimey, I thought, there is more to the world than we think. Oh, yes. I was looking for anything to ease the pain and swelling. And with mainstream medicine giving up on me, I had to search elsewhere. I'd been given a jar of pills called Indocin after the end your career verdict at Coventry. I'm warned that I could be in a wheelchair in my 30s, given the young age at which the arthritis began. I had one reply to that. No way is that going to happen. I also asked if the Indocin would cure the arthritis. No, I was told. It would just ease the pain. Right, you can stick that then, I thought. Even at this early age, I was extremely sceptical about drug companies and their products, thanks to my father. This was just as well. I later read that Indocin and the same non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs under other trade names are rather less than good for your health. Quote, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, cause an increased risk of serious cardiovascular thrombotic events, including myocardial infarction and stroke, which can be fatal. This risk may occur early in treatment and may increase with duration of use. NSAIDs cause an increased risk of serious gastrointestinal adverse events, including bleeding, ulceration, and perforation of the stomach or intestines, which can be fatal. These events can occur at any time during use and without warning symptoms. I was prescribed these at 19 and told nothing about those potential effects or a list of other adverse consequences, which is so long, it's shocking. If I had taken them, I would have been dead long ago, actually murdered by Big Pharma and the doctor who advised me to take them without regard to the effects or even warning me about them. Linda told me soon after we met in 1971 that she'd read an article about a man in Kenilworth, just down the road from Leamington Spa, who was healing people with something called acupuncture. I went to see him. And it turned out that he had read about my arthritis story in the local paper. I had not just found an acupuncture practitioner. I'd found Professor J.R. Worsley, who is described today as being universally acknowledged as the father and master teacher of five-element acupuncture in the modern world, who brought this system of medicine to the West. He and others at his practice basically kept me playing football in the Hereford years, against all the odds. I remember hurting my wrist in training one Thursday morning, 2 days before a game, and I was told I would never be fit in time to play. I left training and drove the 70 miles to Kenilworth for some needles in the wrist, and I trained the next morning with the wrist no problem. I've always been open to other ways of doing things and suspicious of authority in all its forms. I became very interested in acupuncture, which clearly helped me when mainstream medicine could not. I read about why it worked and listened to the explanations of Professor Worsley during the treatments. The body is a field of energy, information, and acupuncture is balancing the flow with its hair-like needles and other techniques. My mind was already opening to other ways of seeing the world. While the arthritis was painful, it also gave me many gifts, and not least in unleashing unbreakable determination. Acupuncture is a perfect example of how the suppression of knowledge makes you ignorant of what is possible. People say you can't put a needle in the foot to cure a headache. Their five-sense body-mind myopia perceives only dots and cannot see how the foot and the head can be connected. Well, they can if the body field is interpenetrated by energy flows of information called meridians, and these operate in circuits with some passing through the foot and the head. If the blockage or disturbance in the flow of that line in the foot leads to a headache further along the circuit, what's the point in putting the needle in the head? Oh, says the five senses, I didn't know that. No, you know next to nothing about anything. That's the trouble. The end of my football career, ironically, came between seasons in the summer of 1973. In the last few weeks of the previous season, the pain had gone and I could actually warm up almost normally every morning. The spring temperatures helped, but it was more than that. I had just turned 21 and signed a new contract with Hereford as we headed into Division 3 when the end finally came. I was getting to bed one night and I looked down at my left knee to see that it wasn't swollen for the first time since that blow in the thigh in 1968. My God, I've cracked it, I thought. It's gone. The next morning, I woke up in a half sleep and realized that I couldn't breathe or move. I tried to knock Linda lying beside me. Nothing happened. I was frozen rigid. I was sure I was going to die until eventually I gasped a breath and immediately feeling surge back through my body, a feeling that knives were being thrust into every joint. I went to bed a professional footballer and woke up never to play again. Linda had to help me even to the toilet in the first 3 days. No lower joint would work, and when I tried, it was excruciating. I hoped that it would settle down again before the next season started in a couple of months. While it improved, it was never enough to play. The club hospital doctor advised me to stop playing, not that I needed to be told that, when I simply couldn't play by then. When I tried to start pre-season training, the pain was too much and I couldn't hide it anymore. The manager, Colin Addison, asked me to meet him in his office one lunchtime, and the hour before I got the verdict from the hospital. What followed was a bizarre interaction in which he was telling me he didn't think I was trying hard enough in training. I was in agony. And I was telling him my career was over. It took a while for him to hear me. I would later look back on my life and see that doors were opening and closing. When one closed, another opened. When one thing stopped, something else would start, with no lag time in between. It seemed for years like mere coincidence. Later, I would realize there was something else going on. The local Hereford paper ran a front-page lead story about the end of my career, and I was asked to be interviewed live on the television show ATV Today in Birmingham, which covered the Hereford area. The interviewer was a well-known sports presenter, Gary Newbon, and he was talking to me with my career just ended and to cricketer Mike Hendrick, who was starting a career as an England bowler. The interview was a segment in the early evening news magazine show, and the three of us tiptoed into the studio as the news was being read. Newbon was pacing up and down, and I looked around at the presenters, cameras and lights and felt the tension in the atmosphere. I remember thinking, "Ikey, this is for you, son." I did the interview and asked Newbon afterwards how I could get into television. He said it normally happened through newspapers and radio. As we drove home, I told Linda that I was going to work in television, and I set my ambition to present a BBC sports programme called Grandstand, which spanned the whole of Saturday afternoon and later Sunday too. The two main hosts were Frank Boff and David Coleman, and I'd first watched Coleman present the show as a kid in the late 1950s. It seemed to most people to be a ridiculous goal. I'd set out as a 10-year-old to be a professional goalkeeper, which at that time was confined to just 92 people in professional first teams each Saturday. Now, I wanted to present a TV show that only a handful of people ever did in its entire run between 1958 and 2007. Enter, once again, at just the right time, Coventry City director John Kampkin, who called to ask me what I plan to do now. I told him I wanted to be a journalist with a view to getting into television, and he said he would talk to a few people he knew from his own time in newspapers and TV. I always had journalism in my mind as a second string, as I devoured news and sports programmes and papers from quite an early age, especially the coverage of Leicester City games by a writer on the local Leicester Mercury, Laurie Simpkin. He would later give me a job on the paper in another remarkable synchronicity. John Kampkin came back to me with an offer from an old friend of his on the London Daily Mail, who was head of a journalism college in Harlow, Essex, to which newspapers in the Midlands and the south of England sent their young journalists to be trained. His name was Bill Hicks, namesake of the brilliant and spiritually profound American comedian. And he said that if I came down and passed the entrance exam for acceptance into his college, he would recommend me to all the newspapers he worked with. I did pass, and he kept his word. Only two papers responded, the Kent Messenger and, more synchronicity, the Leicester Advertiser, which was part of the Leicester Mercury Group. The lack of interest was twofold. All footballers in those days were considered to be thick, see journalists today, and I had no educational qualifications whatsoever after leaving school at 15 to play football. The nearest I came to university was playing for Oxford United, and would-be journalists were invariably expected to be university graduates, as if that somehow ensured basic intelligence. It doesn't. It means you have a good memory, a good enough memory to take what you have been told and repeat that on an exam paper. Innate intelligence, which can't be taught, is something very different. And today's excuse for journalism is almost entirely devoid of that in the mainstream. The industry demands compliant clones, not innately intelligent people who will pursue the truth for the truth's sake. The basics of journalism, as with writing in general, are not difficult. Writing books, for example, is simply having a conversation via the written word with a reader. And proper journalism is telling people what they need to know and asking the questions the public would like to ask but can't. These questions include what happened, why, how, when, and who was involved. Today's fake journalism might sometimes tell you what happened, if you are really lucky and there is not the usual spin. What it does not tell you is why it happened in terms of the real context and implications. Nor will it tell you, most of the time, especially with crucial subjects and societal changes, who is really responsible for what is happening behind the scenes. To our fake journalists, there is no behind the scenes or manipulation from the shadows. That is always a conspiracy theory, no matter what the scale of evidence to support it. Journalism today is a propaganda machine, a mass perceptual manipulation operation, and nothing more. The COVID era has proved this beyond doubt. More than that, this journalistic fakery seeks to demonize and dismiss those in the alternative and independent media who do still work to uncover the truth. How the fakes sleep at night is beyond me, although given their lack of integrity and self-awareness, I suspect, like a baby, would be the answer. The Leicester Advertiser offered me the job on the basis that no one else wanted it. The paper covered every area of Leicestershire where hardly anyone lived. All the urban areas had their own paper, and the Advertiser covered everywhere else. There were more sheep on my patch than people. I would go to village stores, post offices, and the local vicar to find out news to report. Oh, you've got to bring a buy sale. Oh, there's a concert at the village hall. Quick, hold the front page. We had a 3-day working week in Britain soon after I started, to preserve coal stocks in response to a miners' strike. I attended a village parish council meeting in which the main hall was closed and everyone sat around a gas fire in the tiny kitchen discussing village happenings. A few months earlier, I had run into my goal at Hereford United with the crowd chanting my name, and now I was sitting in a village hall kitchen listening to discussions about street lamps. I'm not knocking journalism at this level. It is necessary in any democracy, and many local papers have since sadly been systematically destroyed. The experience just did not fit my vision of a campaigning journalist. Still, hey, it was a start. My eyes were on Grandstand, which seemed such a long way off. My visits to post offices, vicars, and local grocery stores were more Cowangate than Watergate, and if the Leicester Advertiser circulation had been human, it would have been on a life support machine. The Advertiser was a tax write-off for the Leicester Mercury and little more. This was the bottom rung of bottom rungs, and I had to get out of here. I began to do radio reports of Leicester City matches on Saturdays for a local news agency owned by a real character, Roland Orton. Pretty soon he offered me a job in his office on the same floor as BBC Radio Leicester. My close proximity and football background led to me becoming their Leicester City match reporter, my first work, albeit minor, with the BBC. This was alongside all my news work with Rowland's Leicester News Agency, which sold its news and sports reports to local and national papers and radio stations. It was a big step up from the village store. My first football report with Rowland was for BRNB Radio in Birmingham, who, within a few years, I would be working for. News agency work puts you on call pretty much 24/7, and I was its only regular reporter, with one or two others coming and going. I wanted the more predictable hours of working defined shifts on a newspaper, and my eye was on the Leicester Mercury. They couldn't offer me anything on the main paper, but there was a job going on one of their other papers, the Loughborough Monitor. I took it in the hope that something would come up eventually on the Mercury, which it did. Loughborough is in the north of Leicestershire, and I lived south of Leicester in the village of Croft. Linda and I were pretty much skint trying to pay a mortgage, and when our car literally fell apart, like the one John Charles sold me, my time at the Monitor consisted of getting up before the sun, walking half a mile for a bus to the nearest railway station, getting a train into Leicester, changing trains for one to Loughborough, and then walking right across the town to the Monitor offices, all before 9 a.m. I would work through my lunchtime to leave an hour early to do the reverse trip. Happy days. The Mercury job came at last and was offered by Laurie Simpkin. I spent 2 great years there learning the trade. What I found strange is that despite spending all that time living and working in and around Leicester between the Advertiser and the Mercury, I never once came across any of the kids that I knew at 3 separate schools, even though the Mercury job took me constantly all around the city. I continued to live in Croft and spent lots of time in Leicester when I took my next job with BRNB in Birmingham. Still, I met no one. Throughout my pre-1990 life, I had an unquenchable inner drive pushing me on. First, to be a footballer, despite the arthritis, and then to reach the goal of grandstand. The drive was relentless, which stopped me settling anywhere for long, and much as I like working on the Mercury, I successfully applied to BRNB to work as a radio journalist in their newsroom in Birmingham at the old ATV television studios in Aston, next to the Ansell's Beer and HP Sauce factories. If you haven't experienced the aromatic combination of beer and brown sauce at 6 a.m. in the morning after a good night out, you have not lived. I worked there for yet another 2 years, learning to be a broadcaster, with a break in the middle after the intervention again of John Kampkin and also Jimmy Hill, who was my brief first manager at Coventry City and now a famous football broadcaster and pundit. They had been given the contract to improve football in Saudi Arabia, and John wanted me to be part of the team. The money was way more than I was earning as a journalist, with a big catch. The contract I was offered lasted 2 years, with no wife or family allowed, in the light of the lunatic Saudi anti-women laws. By this time, Kerry was born, and that was obviously a big consideration. I was sick of being skint and having old cars that didn't work, which was a constant theme from the time I left school. Here was a chance to end all that, and I took the job. I lasted not 2 years, but 8 weeks. I was trying to come home almost from the first day. Saudi Arabia was a crazy country with crazy laws imposed by crazy people. Some that I met were lovely if utterly controlled by their religion, while the authorities and their minions were head cases. even more so today under the psychopath crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. All that oil money stolen from the people by the fascist fake royal families did not shield the country from being utterly chaotic. I miss my family and sod the money. It didn't matter to me anymore. I wanted out. John Kamkin could see that I wasn't happy and suggested I go back home for a week and think it through. He knew, as I did, that once I was on that plane to Heathrow, there would be no return flight. Those 2 months, however, gave me a later very useful front seat experience of Saudi Arabia and its hypocrisies, like alcohol shipped in secretly for the royals through fronts like furniture importers, while strict and extreme Islamic laws were enforced by those same hand-chopping, head-chopping royals, who are not royals at all. They are non-Islamic interlopers, as they are in all the other royal-controlled Arab countries, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Qatar. See my comprehensive 9/11 expose book, The Trigger. More synchronicity followed when I returned to the UK. My old job at BRMB was now filled, but a guy I had worked with was just leaving, and there was a perfectly timed space for me to return. We had lots of laughs, especially surrounding a character in often bright used car salesman suits called Tony Butler, who presented sport for the station. He was wary of me. I think he believed I wanted his job, when that was absolutely the last thing on my mind. Grandstand was on my mind, nothing else. I remember Tony coming on the phone furious when I was reporting on a game from Coventry City's ground. I was a news journalist while covering football at the weekend. Coventry's ground was sparsely attended that day, with spectators dotted around the concrete terrace. I described the ground as looking like concrete spotted dick, which is a suet pudding dotted with dried fruit. Its delights had obviously eluded Tony Butler, who came on the phone to tell me I could not say dick on the radio. Nevertheless, the word did come to mind as I put the phone down. I stayed another year at BRMB before I saw an ad for a regional journalist at the BBC's Birmingham studio on a show called Midlands Today, which I'd watched since I was a kid. Its presenters and reporters like Tom Coyne, Alan Towers and Geoffrey Green were household names in the Midlands, and now I was about to join them as I was offered the job. The term regional journalist was defined in the job description as writing news scripts with occasional appearances in vision. I thought, sod that. I was not going to be that close to my goal of television and sit in the background. I was now working for the BBC that produced Grandstand. This was no time to slacken the pace. I spent my spare time while working my notice at BRMB in the Midlands Today newsroom, learning as much as I could before I started. And on the Saturday of my first week, when I had a BBC pass to get into any building, I was down to London to watch Grandstand go out. In doing so, I would meet many of the people I would be working with a few years later. They included the presenter Frank Boff, whose charm and easy style made him rightly a television legend. He was real nice to me that day. Whoa, I had made it to the Grandstand studio, and I wasn't leaving it there. Back at Midlands Today, I noticed that when the designated reporters had been sent out on diary jobs in the morning, events we knew were happening, any news story that broke would have to be covered by one of the group of regional journalists. I also noticed that these stories would often come to our attention during the lunch break, and I began taking sandwiches and sitting in the newsroom on my own while everyone else headed for the BBC bar. Day after day, the producer would put his head around the door to find me alone in the newsroom. David, grab a crew. There's a story to cover. Very soon, occasional appearances in vision became on the program every night, and I was redesignated to be a full-time reporter. I would volunteer for the weekend jobs and spent several nights after work with the between program continuity presenter, the lovely David Stevens, fine-tuning my presentation skills. It reminded me of all those extra hours on the training pitch that I chose to do at Coventry City. I was asked what I wanted to achieve when I first joined Coventry. I could have said a top player or first team player. I said that I wanted to be the best goalkeeper that ever lived. That was me. Limited horizons were not my style. Once the little boy in the big boots became history. Something was always driving me to be the best that I could be at whatever I did. This didn't apply to the rest of my life. I wasn't obsessive in that way. But if I wanted to achieve something, I went for it with everything I had. This has remained so ever since, although these days in a much more laid-back way. The drive is still there, but the gotta has subsided with age and experience. Again, the established presenters and reporters on Midlands Today, who I'd watched as a kid, thought I was trying to usurp them. This was especially true of Tom Coyne, who feared the next cleaner was going to replace him as presenter of the show. His demeanour on and off camera couldn't have been more different, and I was to find the same with so many in television. Geoffrey Green, then at an advanced age, was especially wary of this young whippersnapper as he perceived me. He was a miserable old bugger, but I liked him for all that. Once again, they had all misread me. I didn't want their jobs or to override them. I wanted to go through Midlands Today as fast as possible and head for London and Grandstand. I stayed a couple of years, a recurring theme that happened many times. 2 years at Hereford United, the Leicester Advertiser, Leicester News Agency, Leicester Mercury, BRNB, Midlands Today. And the same with my next job, presenting sport for the national London-based BBC current affairs show, Newsnight, which still continues today. I was offered that job in the same period as another with the Midlands Today rival, ATV Today, which became Central News. What synchronicity that would have been had I taken the ATV job and presented the same show in the same studio where I was interviewed by Gary Newbon, who was still there, when my football career ended. The studio where I decided that TV was my new goal. ATV Today, however, was based in Birmingham, and Newsnight was at the main BBC television centre in London, where I saw that edition of Grandstand go out. ATV was offering significantly more money to leave the BBC, and yet that was not going to influence my choice at all. The BBC equals Grandstand, and that meant more to me than money. It was a good choice to turn down ATV, with the Newsnight offer coming shortly afterwards, and that would soon lead to Grandstand. I'd specialised in news since I became a journalist, with sport as an add-on here and there. And for the first time with Newsnight, it was going to be full-time sport. Events now began to move very fast. Within a few months of moving from regional television to Newsnight, where national TV producers could see me, I had a call in the Newsnight office. "Hello, David. This is Martin Hopkins at Grandstand." My mouth went dry. Grandstand! At the end of the show, as the football results came in at 5:45 and the audience was at its peak, there was a spot where a presenter named Tony Gubber would round up all the games not covered by reporters from the grounds and go through the new league positions as they were after the day's results. Martin Hopkins, a long-time Grandstand stalwart, said Gubber would be away for 2 weeks soon and would I be interested in filling in. Well, it took me 0.1 of a second to say yes. And he said he would check with a few people and come back to me in an hour or so. I paced the floor, waiting for the call. And when it came, he said, "Okay, you're on." I did a jig around the office in some disbelief at what had just happened. I went to the grandstand studio for the next 2 weeks to follow Tony through his afternoon to see what was required. And then the day came of my first grandstand appearance. The slot was maybe 5 minutes long, but very intense and almost entirely ad lib, apart from a written opening with endless crossings out and added words when games changed with very late goals. There were pictures of relevant players to include too, and it was always bordering on disaster because it was so rushed. The slot was delivered literally minutes after the games ended, and the information about changes in the league tables was often slipped to you while you were live on air, and given it was handwritten, you hoped you could make sense of it. Frank Boff handed over to me, and I just about got through the first one, with the brilliant Martin Hopkins speaking in my ear. I was shattered afterwards by the sheer intensity of the concentration. If I cocked it up, that would be the end of me with Grandstand. Anything less than quality, and they were not interested. The following week, I was back and compiled my opening script with the usual late changes and went across to sit next to Frank. A football report was being delivered on the phone, and when it was finished, I knew I would be on live. I sat down and looked at my papers to see nothing but a blank sheet. My heart went walkabout. I sifted through the papers and no opening script. "I haven't got my script," I said out loud. Seconds before I was on air, John Tidy, who oversaw all the graphics and captions for the show, came over and said, "Is this what you want?" It was the script. I could have kissed him. The next thing I hear is Frank Boff saying, "And now here's David Icke with the rest of the football." The end of my grandstand career was that close. I was so relieved that my whole body relaxed and I delivered the slot with supreme confidence that surviving near disaster can give you. "You read that well," Frank said to me afterwards, confirming the finest of lines between success and disaster. Within a few weeks, I was given the spot permanently. I was now part of the grandstand team. The experience also introduced me to the joys of open talkback. Presenters wear earpieces so the gallery can talk to them while live on air. Up to this point, you heard silence unless the producer pressed a button to speak. With open talkback, which is what I had for the rest of my television career from here on, the connection was always open, and you heard everything happening in the gallery and everything being said. You had to pick out and respond to what was relevant to you while you were speaking to camera and leave the rest. Live sports shows tended to change so quickly that producers could not be burdened with pressing a button every time they wanted to speak with you. Instead, you heard the lot. I continued working with Newsnight with Grandstand on Saturdays, watching and learning at close range from legendary presenters Frank Boff and David Coleman, both of whom I'd watched as a kid in Leicester. I got on well with them both. Coleman had a reputation for being hard to work with and super critical. I saw through that bullshit to a man who had a big heart behind it all. Like so many people, he had a vulnerability and insecurity that the apparently arrogant side was designed to cover. I was offered a full-time contract in 1982 with the BBC Sports Department after being given leave from Newsnight to work on the World Cup that year in Spain. I was designated to cover the Northern Ireland team, which was expected to play only the initial group games before being eliminated. Instead, they became one of the biggest stories of the tournament as they qualified for the next stage after beating the host country Spain and Valencia, where we were based. I sat next to an advertising board directly behind the Spanish goalkeeper in the first half, where the Irish scored the game's only goal. Alongside me was producer Brian Barwick, who would go on to be head of BBC Sport and chief executive of the Football Association. Brian was a brash Liverpudlian then, maybe still is. Once he saw that I don't take shit from anybody, we got on well, and I liked him a lot, as I did the Welsh rugby great Cliff Morgan, who headed the BBC Department of Sport and Outside Broadcasts. He asked to meet me after the World Cup to congratulate me on my work, and we had a wonderful chat. Cliff was an emotional man who loved language and had the gifts of a Welsh orator. I remember he said to me that day, "David, never lose your sense of wonder." I never have. My full-time arrival at BBC Sport coincided with the 1982 Commonwealth Games in Brisbane, when virtually every presenter and reporter headed for Australia, and the few of us left behind had to host all the UK-based shows. Suddenly, almost in an instant, I was all over national TV as part of the early morning Commonwealth Games programmes, then grabbed a few hours sleep before presenting the primetime Horse of the Year show from Wembley Arena in the evening, while knowing absolutely nothing about horses. I was running on fumes by the end of the week, but it was the start of a phenomenal few years in which my face was constantly on the British TV screen, working on all the shows I'd watched so intently as a boy, including the main football programme, Match of the Day. This was famously presented by Jimmy Hill, my first manager at Coventry, and the man ultimately behind the operation in Saudi Arabia. Jimmy was an intense man when it came to football, and very funny with a sharp sense of humour and fun. I found myself by far the youngest presenter at BBC Sport. I was only 30 in 1982. Working with the legends of sports broadcasting history, they have never been surpassed, and in the often bland world of broadcasting today, they never will be. All of them were unique, broke-the-mould characters. Apart from Jimmy Hill, there were presenters Coleman, Boff, later Des Lynham, and commentators Coleman, football and athletics, Harry Carpenter, boxing, Peter O'Sullivan, horse racing, Richie Beno, cricket, John Arlott, cricket, Peter Alice, golf, Ron Pickering, athletics, Brendan Foster, athletics, Murray Walker, motor racing, Ted Lowe, snooker, Eddie Waring, rugby league, Bill McLaren, rugby union, Dan, oh I say, Maskell, tennis, David Vine, snooker, skiing, anything that moved, Sid Waddell, darts, and John Motson, football. I first met Motson with more synchronicity at the pre-match lunch before Hereford United beat Newcastle in that FA Cup shocker in 1972. His commentary on the game would launch his career. Another famous voice, if not so much face, was Len Martin, who read the football results on Grandstand from the first edition in 1958 to his death in 1995. It may not seem such a big deal today to read the soccer scores, but everyone alive in Britain at that time knew the unique voice and delivery of Len Martin. I was there in the halcyon days of BBC Sport, before sport broadcasting contracts were lost to pay-per-view channels and the department became the comparative rump that it is today. I regard my time there as an absolute privilege. I also worked alongside some of Britain's most famous and again legendary newsreaders when I was asked to present the sport on BBC News every Saturday night in a slot that had one of the highest national audiences of the week as it followed the also legendary BBC Saturday Night Entertainment lineup, now long gone. Two of the news presenters were Moira Stewart, one of the nicest people I worked with in television, and the lovely Jill Dando, who would later be murdered on her doorstep by a still unknown assassin. My most poignant memory of those BBC News days came on April the 15th, 1989. Match of the Day was covering the FA Cup semi-final at Hillsborough, Sheffield, between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest. The game was not aired live, but I could watch it live as the coverage came into Television Centre in London to be recorded. I watched as something unpleasant was clearly unfolding early in the game, and I shouted across to the news desk to switch to the football. Something bad is happening here. It was bad, real bad. I was watching the Hillsborough disaster, in which 96 Liverpool supporters died, children and adults, in the crush that followed the South Yorkshire police decision to allow far too many people to enter an already tightly packed area behind one of the goals. A disgusting police cover-up began, and it took tenacious families decades to eventually secure a verdict that the police and not the fans were responsible for the tragedy. But don't worry, conspiracies never happen, right? That's just a theory. My television career included presenting a Friday evening slot on Nationwide, a major show of the day. And I was in the original presenting team, led by Frank Boff and Selina Scott, on Breakfast Time, the UK's first breakfast TV show, launched amid huge publicity and fanfare in 1983. Princess Diana came on a royal visit in the early weeks, some 2 years after she married Prince Charles, and I was introduced to her. I was taken aback by how tall she was and by the look of sheer fear in her eyes, which I didn't understand until events later played out. 15 years later, I would be exposing the background to her assassination in a Paris road tunnel in The Biggest Secret. I particularly liked Selina Scott in my Breakfast Time years. She was a genuine woman, untouched by the fame and hysteria that surrounded her at the time, and which clearly irked Frank Boff, who saw himself as the show's star. Selina interviewed me much later when she worked for Sky News, and I was in the middle of mass ridicule. She was just as warm and friendly as I remembered her, and she treated me with rare respect in the mainstream media. I was also a presenter on a young people's program, Saturday Superstore, which began in 1982, presented by disc jockey Mike Reed and Sarah Green, alongside one of the stars of children's TV at the time, Keith Chegwin. Keith was a great bloke. I met him a lot of years later in a motorway service area car park, and although I was portrayed as the national nutter by then, he, like Selina Scott, was warm, friendly and respectful. I'll always remember Keith for that and his endless laughter. Saturday Superstore allowed me to meet all the famous people and pop stars of the day, as I did on Breakfast Time. Talking of which, I met the Monkees singer, Davy Jones, on a train to London once. He came into my compartment as I headed for the BBC and he went to his West End show. Davy has got to be one of the nicest people I ever chatted with. And like Selina and Keith, there was not a hint of showbiz me, me, me. My focus was always on the next ambition, and I never really savoured and enjoyed what I'd achieved. The next goal was always on my mind. Okay, done that, now what? These were the running shoes I came out of the womb already wearing. Writing this brief biography section, and my God, there's so much more, has made me look at my life anew. I was everywhere on TV in those days and experienced so much even before the top of my head blew off in 1990 and 91. And so back to Grandstand. This had been the incessant ambition since the end of my football career, and it was secured in the mid-1980s when I was asked to present a run of the Sunday version. All those years, well, only about 12 in fact, and all that effort, and here I was driving into London from my then home in Oakley, Buckinghamshire, to do my first show. There were tears in my eyes at the thought of picking myself off the ground when my football dreams were in tatters, my body racked in pain, and immediately setting another target in that Birmingham TV studio. Now, here I was, about to achieve it. The grandstands went very well, but something strange began to happen. With my ambition secured, I lost interest in television. The fire in my belly that drove me forward towards Grandstand dramatically waned, and while I still did my best, my heart was no longer in it. Television is a very vacuous world of backstabbing, inward-looking myopia, and the BBC sports department was run by many people who would be a therapist's life's work. I was never a mixer away from the studio setting, and that became ever more pronounced as my heart retreated from the TV world. I would prepare my scripts at home on the Isle of Wight, where I moved in 1982, travel to London as late as I could to do a show, and have a taxi with the engine running outside Television Centre, time for the closing titles. I was on the train home at London's Waterloo Railway Station before the rest of the crew were in the BBC bar. Mike Murphy, the grandstand editor who gave me those shows and promised many more, left the BBC, and he was replaced by one of those people for whom a therapist would need no other clients. Grandstand and me were parting company, and in the greater scheme of my life, it was, with hindsight, exactly what needed to happen. I was increasingly marginalised by the London end of BBC Sport, but I had a final and glorious Indian summer with the far more humane Manchester operation, headed by a proper decent bloke, Nick Hunter. He has never been given the credit he deserves for taking a marginal game in snooker and making it a global television phenomenon in the 1980s. Nick hired me as a snooker presenter as my London career was waning and put me before TV audiences that the London people could only dream about. Snooker simply exploded as a focus of national attention, and the players were amazing one-off characters, including Cliff Thorburn, Bill Werbenick, Kirk Stevens, the brilliant Jimmy White, Ray Reardon, John Virgo, Terry Griffiths, John Spencer, Dennis Taylor, and the mercurial genius turned always destined tragedy, Alex Hurricane Higgins. Alex could be the nicest man and the worst in the same few minutes. Snooker reached its peak audience with the 1985 World Championship final presented by my colleague David Vine between the world's top player Steve Davis and Irish underdog Dennis Taylor, which went to the last ball of the best of 35-frame match before Taylor won. The audience reached 18.5 million, close to a third of the UK population at the time, and remains to this day both the record viewing figure for the BBC Two channel and the biggest past midnight audience in British television history. With today's multi-channel dilution of audiences, it will never be beaten. That was snooker in those days. It was a wonderful time, and again, a privilege to be part of that. I did my last snooker world championship with Nick in the spring of 1990 at the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield. My BBC and entire television career was only 2 months from reaching its conclusion. As my interest in television faded from the mid-1980s, my mind turned to other things and primarily what human economic activity was doing to what I then perceived as the natural world much more later. I don't mean the global warming hoax, see COVID hoax sprung by the same people, that was starting to emerge. This was far from the dominating factor in the so-called green movement as it has become today. Greens then cared about all aspects of environmental assault, and that would have included the extraordinary impact of mass mask wearing, which Greens in general have encouraged, even demanded, no matter what the environmental consequence. My concerns involved the way beautiful landscapes were being destroyed by inappropriate building, and how the environment was being deluged by pollution at all levels, air, food, water, the lot. My interest began on the Isle of Wight when I saw landscapes and unique urban and village areas destroyed by buildings that a child could have designed and in no way sympathetic to what was already there. It wasn't a case of stop all development. It was rather what kind of development and where. I came to realize that these decisions were being made by a network of Freemasons and Satanists on the island, collectively referred to as the Island Mafia, which controlled the local councils, a single council today, and in particular the planning department that had the major say in what was built or not. In other words, who could make fantastic profits from developments that the council sanctioned. When you can vastly increase the value of land by giving planning permission for development, corruption will always be rife. The Isle of Wight was, is, awash with it. The island is still widely beautiful, despite the best efforts of the mafia, but it has a very dark and satanic underbelly, which understandably has contempt for me. I take that as an honour and a compliment. I helped to create Island Watch, an organisation pledged to campaign against inappropriate development and the corruption involved. It was now that I began to appreciate the influence of Freemasons and other secret societies as I realized that the decisions the council apparently made in public in the evening were actually being decided at the Freemasons' lodge in the afternoon. Public debate was therefore a farce. I pondered about going into politics to challenge this and the increasing centralization of power fast emerging, known as globalization. I looked first at the Liberal Party, now the Liberal Democrats, in the mid-1980s, which returned the island member of parliament, and I was in for a crash course in political hypocrisy, mendacity, and deceit. God, it was horrible, and the people appalling. This is how bad. Soon after I joined the Liberal, note Liberal Party, I made a cash contribution to a local council-run school for the disabled after being shown little kids so brain-damaged that all they could do was lie on a plastic flat-top vehicle with wheels and do their best to use their feet to make it move. Looking at their faces wouldn't fail to break your heart. Well, if you had one, I mean. Staggeringly, the head of the school told me they were short of these vehicles due to lack of funds. I was dumbstruck at the callous injustice, and I handed over the money they needed for some more. My donation was never publicised, and nor was it meant to be, but it got back to leading members of the local Liberal Party, which ran the council at the time. This led to the most prominent of them, a guy called Maurice Barton, telling me that I should not have made the donation. He said that it left them open to being condemned by the political opposition for not funding the school adequately enough to the point where a member of the party had to give money himself. I was very new to politics, and I was dumbstruck and gutted to the core at what I was hearing. The Liberal Party and me parted company with swift effect. Maurice Barton was the most classic politician, and if he had ever told the truth, his body would have genetically imploded from the shock. He was not an exception, however, just an example of the worldwide breed. I then turned my attention to the Green Party that had recently changed its name from the Ecology Party. It was intellectually headed by what I found to be an incredibly arrogant man, Jonathan Porritt. Its policy material, however, included so much that I could support. The party was campaigning for environmental sanity and also justice and fairness for all. It was then, anyway. Don't start me on the woke green movement of today, which believes freedom of speech and opinion is not a right but a crime. I wrote to the head office to ask if they had a contact on the Isle of Wight, and they replied that there was no Green Party on the island, which I already knew, and not even a contact. This would be 1988. The reply encouraged me to start an island branch, and I organised a few public meetings, and away we went. What happened next was utterly ridiculous and made me wonder for the first time about a force guiding my life. A couple of weeks after starting the Isle of Wight branch, we had a letter from the regional party inviting us to send a delegate to its quarterly meeting of all the local parties in the south of central England at Winchester in Hampshire. I went along, and after hours of meaningless naval contemplating, the chair lady said that the regional party's representative on National Party Council was stepping down that day and they needed nominations for a replacement. No one volunteered, and so I did, on the basis of someone's got to do it. I'd been a member of the Green Party for a matter of weeks, and now I was on the National Party Council. What? There was a meeting of the council in a couple of weeks, and I arrived at a building near Regent's Park in London, where there was more naval contemplating at a higher level. And just before lunch, the man chairing said they needed to elect speakers to represent the party in the media for the coming year, and he would take nominations when the meeting resumed. During lunch, a man came over and said, "You're on the television, aren't you?" "Yes," I replied. "So you would be confident in the media then?" he continued. "Yes, I guess so." "If you put your name forward as a speaker, I will second you," came the punchline. "Okay, why not? I'm up for anything." A short time later, I was elected a national spokesman for the Green Party. Again, just a matter of weeks after I joined. It was crazy. I didn't think that being officially a national politician would mean much given the tiny Green Party support and the almost total lack of interest by the media. Events would prove otherwise and move fast. Pollution and other environmental concerns began to appear in the mainstream and public attention turned to the subject ahead of the European elections in the summer of 1989. What followed were 2 million votes for the Green Party in Britain, and we were suddenly a player, albeit briefly, on the political stage until the party tore itself apart in a war between the Fundies and the Reelos. These were groups represented by those that wanted to keep the core policies and principles and those that wanted to change them to win more votes and be more acceptable to the mainstream. I was caught in the middle as what I called a Fundy Reelo. I wanted to retain the core principles while presenting them in a clearer and more accessible and professional way. In the wake of the European election success, I was in the national media talking about politics, and this didn't go down well with the BBC sport people and the BBC hierarchy in general. Apparently, there was a conflict between presenting sport and saying the economic system was destroying the environment. I could understand if I was reporting news, but I hadn't done that since I joined Newsnight in 1980. The crunch came when I refused to pay the poll tax or community charge introduced by Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in 1989, and another remarkable series of synchronistic events followed. The tax, in effect, had people on small and large incomes paying the same, which was obviously unfair. And large numbers of people refused to pay in protest. The first court cases for non-payers could have been held anywhere in Britain, and yet it happened in the small town of Newport on the Isle of Wight, where my case was to be heard. The hearings attracted national and wider world attention. I arrived on the bus from Ryde with Linda to find an extraordinary number of photographers surrounding me and moving in unison like a single entity. It was akin to the scene in the movie Notting Hill when a guy opens the door to find a mass of cameras pointing at him. It's happened a few times to me in different situations, and it's quite a sight to experience. There were so many appearing in court that day that they were processing 6 to 8 at a time instead of one. It came to my turn, and in the line with me was a young chap I'd seen at a number of protest meetings. He was very forensic in studying the rules and regulations. As the magistrates were going through what they believed was another group to rubber stamp, he put his hand up and asked to speak. He asked the magistrates when the prosecution summonses to court were sent out to people, and how that compared with the time between non-payment and a summons being issued as dictated by the law. The magistrates consulted with the court clerk. The atmosphere around them and their demeanour visibly changed. They announced an adjournment. When they returned, they said that all the summonses to court that day had been sent out too early, and therefore all the prosecutions delivered were invalid. Everyone was free to go. I put up my hand and pointed out that those summoned to court that day had lost a day's pay plus their travel costs, and these needed to be reimbursed. The magistrates agreed, and I would eventually receive my £2.50 bus fare. Margaret Thatcher's poll tax never recovered from that humiliation at the first legal hurdle, and nor did she. The tax would be replaced, and so would Thatcher the following year, when her own party conspired to remove her. The Iron Lady was not so iron, after all, when people stood up to her. The next day, I had a meeting scheduled at Television Centre in London with the head of sport, Jonathan Martin. He was a system man claiming to have socialist tendencies, and I never really trusted him as I did Cliff Morgan. In fact, by then, Cliff was the only one I did trust at the BBC in London. I walked into Martin's office and the morning papers were all over the table with my picture on the front of most of them after the poll tax debacle in Newport the day before. "What I have to say is nothing to do with those," he said, confirming that it was, at least in part. He said the BBC was not renewing my contract, which had only a few weeks to run. He and they didn't even have the decency to give me longer warning so I could have time to make arrangements for another income. I'd already lost the weekend job on BBC News in a bizarre conversation with the then head of news, Tony Hall, later BBC Director General, as the by then Baron Hall of Birkenhead. The fancy titles are so pathetic. Hall rang to tell me that I could no longer work on the Saturday news programme given my political activities. The problem was that he couldn't blurt out the words. He went round and round the houses. I saved him from his stuttering by saying I thought it would be best if I stood down. "Oh, do you really?" he said. The relief in his voice almost hilariously obvious. So that was it. The end of my television career. Was I gutted? Nope. I had concerns about how to earn a living. But it wasn't only Baron Hall that was relieved. Relief surged through my body. I was free of the nonsense I had come to loathe Nick Hunter and the Manchester team apart. And by then, another life was revealing itself in the most extraordinary way. I had believed that my progress in pursuit of multiple ambitions was down to good luck, hard work, and focus. I was now to realise that my entire life had been heading in a particular direction in many and various ways and expressions. There was never a time in my life when the journey started. There was only the moment when it became conscious. My whole life had been the journey. When I became a national spokesman for the British Green Party in a matter of weeks, I began to reconsider and look back at the pattern. I would set a goal and then achieve it, with lucky breaks happening at precisely the right time. And once the ambition was achieved, something would happen to move me on with a period of around 2 years, often the ballpark time involved. My luck included, but was far from limited to, the big toe-cap boots that led me to kick the ball much harder than the other kid and get into my first school team. The goalkeeper getting injured at the Leicester Schoolboys trial after I had been rejected as an outfield player. The game of my life in the second trial that put me in the team against all the odds and on the road to being a professional footballer. The perfectly timed interventions of John Kampkin with exactly the right contacts in football and media to get me to Hereford United through his friend John Charles, and then into journalism through his friend Bill Hicks. How John Kamkin was based in Leamington Spa, where I'd moved shortly before, because it was the hometown of Linda, who I'd only just met. Finding down the road the world-renowned acupuncturist Professor J.R. Worsley, who kept my career going for 2 years at Hereford when I should never have been playing. Being invited on the ATV Today show 2 days after my career ended, which immediately triggered my TV ambitions that drove me through the disappointment and on to the next target. How I was recommended by John Kamkin's friend Bill Hicks to all those newspapers across the South and Midlands of England, and one of only two that responded, was back in my home city with all that came from that in Leicester. The grandstand break out of nowhere from the programme that had been my target from that day at ATV, and the John Tidy incident when seconds saved me from grandstand disaster, that would have ended that ambition immediately. The never-expected Northern Ireland success in the 1982 World Cup that earned me a contract with BBC Sport, and how I joined just in time for the staff exodus to the 1982 Commonwealth Games in Australia, which immediately gave me the opportunity back home to quickly become a national face. The snooker opportunity at the right time to relaunch my career as it faded in London. The ridiculous speed that I went from joining the Green Party to becoming a national spokesman less than a year before the one big election success, which gave me national exposure as a politician, albeit briefly. Newport, Isle of Wight, of all the towns and cities in the UK, was the first to hold the poll tax court cases, and a man in my line of defendants stopped the prosecutions and made the poll tax and Margaret Thatcher a laughingstock. On and on the list continues with synchronicities, coincidences and luck at the right moment. By the time of the Green Party and poll tax court cases, I didn't believe that it was luck anymore. Yes, I was focused and worked hard, but sorry, that no longer told the whole story. Something strange was happening. The question was, what? I was about to find out.